This is part two now of a podcast on the burned over district of New York. In part one, we set up who occupied upstate New York and the territory a little bit, and established where the ideas of Protestant Christianity that these people were dealing with come from. Now we're going to dive into some of the eccentric figures that came out of the 19th century.
Yes, let's do it.
This section is called Knowing the Divine. At the time of the American Revolution, multiple spiritualist movements mimicked the political upheaval in that they were also democratizing God. Most mainstream Protestant denominations at the time held that God was inherently unknowable and only Scripture could reveal God's will. Mm-hmm. Over the 19th century, Americans increasingly came to believe that God spoke to them directly, dispensing new instructions for creating a perfect Christian world. The fact that this belief became central to American Christianity speaks volumes about American hubris, I think. The first generation of divinely inspired New Yorkers developed techniques that lent legitimacy to the movements that will follow them.
Okay.
Direct revelation is a Pandora's box idea. As we saw in Handsome Lake's case, and we will see in many more stories, conversations with God can quickly become a trump card for winning any argument that you're having.
Yeah.
When multiple members of a community can speak to the divine, this can set off an arms race of revelation.
My first question, though, is this where the phrase talking in tongues came to be? Do we know?
I don't know the origin of that, but yeah. You will see a lot of it.
Okay. Yes, I'm ready.
Yeah. Divine inspiration also provides a powerful tool for upending the status quo,
yeah. Right?
So appealing to the highest possible power allows you to radically remake your community and potentially remake yourself.
Mm. This is so interesting, too, because of course it makes sense that as government is being reorganized, we want to reorganize religion as well. But I never really put those two things together, that we're like renegotiating our relationship with the divine when... Okay, that's what you're getting at.
Yeah.
I'm going to stop undercutting you.
Well, you know, exactly. And you can think, like, as an American in this time, this is also the height of, like, Enlightenment ideas. And there are all these ideas of, like, well, government should be rational and, like, people should have contracts with each other. It shouldn't just be, like, I'm more powerful than you, therefore you do what I say. You know? And so all of this, like, placed power in the individual. And at the same time, the religious thinking around this shifts to, well, the individual is the centerpiece of the spiritual and the religious experience as well. It's no longer about big churches or a book written 1800 years ago.
Yeah, a priest who's been divinely ordained to specifically talk to God.
It's also me. I'm a part of this.
Yeah. Anne Hutchinson really won out in this battle.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think she, she lives much longer than John Winthrop in our culture, I think.
Yes. Okay.
This section's called The Universal Friend.
Okay.
Born in 1752, Jemima Wilkinson lived in Rhode Island during heady times. Along with the Revolution and other movements we've discussed, Great Awakening preachers began performing ecstatic sermons filled with fire and brimstone, emphasizing the need to be born again in Christ as a cataclysmic change in your life, accompanied by a complete rejection of sin.
Was the actual term born again part of the conversation that early? I guess As someone in my own time frame, I always thought of born-again Christianity and that kind of evangelical religion as so contemporary.
So this is the initial root of it. And a lot of historians talk about Great Awakenings as something that never went away, that this was the first one, and then there was a second one, a third one, and then it just became kind of part of the fabric of American life, is that you'd have these evangelical uprisings of this kind. And it was usually based on this idea of, you need to be completely undone by Christ. You need to be eradicated of your previous self. And the born again thing comes from some scripture. I can't quote it off. I'm not quite good enough to be able to quote it.
Me neither.
But there is some scripture around being born again in Christ. And that's the thing that they really latched onto, as like, you don't have to become a Jew, as in the Old Testament, you don't have to enter into the covenant of God.
Yeah.
You can be spontaneously reborn in Christ.
Yeah. It's really good religious marketing, too. Like, it really, it hits. It
yeah.
slaps.
Yeah, it's broad. It really gets you in the door. Yeah. So Jemima Wilkinson took these ideas a little bit further than others. One by one, she and her siblings were kicked out of their local Quaker meetings. Her sister had been dismissed for having an illegitimate child. You know, you love the Quakers, but
I can't handle
they were
the
still
in the Quaker
they were still
armor.
People of their time. I'm sorry, the Quakers were people of their time, and they were conservative Quakers.
I like to think that they came together and hugged her as a loose woman. It's fine. I'll get over it.
They showed her the door. And her brothers had been kicked out for taking up arms in the American Revolution. Quakers are pacifists,
right?
So. Jemima was dismissed for giving ecstatic testimony that strayed too close to the bombastic talk of these new preachers. And at this time, there's also a movement called New Lights, which is related to the Great Ooh. Awakening thing. And the New Lights were saying, as opposed to the Old Lights, who were more, Wait. Like, literally, they called themselves this.
Really?
Yeah.
Why would you ever brand yourself as Old Lights?
as in, you're carrying on, like, the traditional, original church, and there was a lot of hearkening back to what the primitive church was like, as in what before Catholicism formed, what that church was
paleo
all about.
Paleo religion.
Yeah, essentially. Paleo
yes.
religion.
Okay.
So if you were an Old Light, you were more of like this conservative, there was a time.
Okay.
And if you're a New Light, it's Jesus is continuing to give us new revelation that allows us to experience new ways of experiencing God.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Then in October of 1776, in Wilkinson's word, quote, taking her leave of the family between the hour of 9 and 10 in the morning, she dropped the dying flesh and yielded up the ghost. And according to the declaration of angels, the spirit took full possession of the body it now animates.
I have a lot of questions.
One second. When Jemima died, quote, the spirit of life from God had descended to earth and to warn a lost and guilty, perishing, dying world, to flee from the wrath which is to come, and to give an invitation to the lost sheep of the house of Israel to come home. The spirit that now inhabited Jemima Wilkinson's body went by the name Public Universal Friend. Recall that Quakers called each other friend. This friend ministered not just to a certain Quaker congregation, she was a friend to all. She was the universal friend. Unfortunately, this openness was not returned by her society.
So in her telling, Jemima died, and a divine ghost took her place in her corporeal body.
Exactly.
Okay.
Jemima was dead. She right. was no more. Now, this body was the public universal friend.
Did she label herself as like a holy ghost?
Sort of. It's complicated.
I mean, of course.
So the Public Universal Friend, which we can call Puff for short.
Love it.
Puff. The Puff adopted the black clerical robes of a preacher, a broad-brimmed Quaker hat, while retaining long, curly hair. They spoke with masculine, feminine tone of voice in a kind of croak. Mm. It's hard to know what pronouns to use, because the Universal Friend avoided pronouns altogether. Refused pronouns.
Puff, ahead of their time.
Puff was ready. I'm going to take an ahistorical stance, and I'm going to use they in Kay. Reference to Puff.
Okay.
Sources of the time usually use the pronoun she, so if I quote something, it might have a she in it. Usually with the insistence that Jemima Wilkinson was lying and, you know, was still a woman.
We'll see.
We'll see. The Puff wasted no time in starting their new ministry.
I have a really fabulous mental picture of Puff, too, that I'm really enjoying. Continue.
They began speaking at Quaker meetings in, where else? Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
Place where weird religionists go.
Place of outlaws.
Yes.
Rule breakers.
Yeah. Quote, after she had uttered a few words, a friend stood up and desired her to sit down. But she, not submitting, the same request was repeated by another, and then another, and another, until no less than five friends required her to desist.
Ooh.
But she said, as it was the Lord who spoke by her, she could not be silent until they applied their hands to her mouth. So this is the Public Universal Friend refusing to stand down at Quaker meetings.
Which I would imagine is the number one rule you cannot break at a Quaker
party. Yeah, if a friend asks you to do something, pretty much if a friend asks you to do something, you're supposed to do it.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Despite resistance from more conservative members of society, the public universal friend found themselves in regular demand at churches of all kinds for the next few years.
Interesting.
Their revelation was straightforward and relatable. Mm-hmm. The end was nigh, and denial of pleasure and sin, especially sex, was imperative. The eccentric claim of not having just spoken to God, but of being a spirit sent from God, gave Puff authority and attention far beyond what a preaching woman like Jemima Wilkinson would have been able to command. Mm. In fact, Jemima Wilkinson couldn't get a license to preach. Women couldn't preach in America at this time.
Of course.
Yeah. And weirdly, to escape that, rather than getting a preaching license, Jemima Wilkinson got rid of femininity entirely.
And this is not the first time that had been done in history. This is a really interesting, like, connection to... Anyway, keep going.
Yeah. I can put in a little plug. I did a podcast on people who live their lives in a gender other than what they were assigned at birth throughout history. So.
Yeah, I think there's this contemporary idea that that's a modern construction when actually it's absolutely not.
Yeah. And often what I found by doing that was that it often was people assigned woman, female at birth,
yeah,
who lived as men to have more opportunity in life.
And who can disagree thing. With that,
exactly.
That perspective.
Yeah. And it's hard. It's interesting to relate to transness because it's not quite the same thing. It's much more motivated by these like social conditions. And so kind of stands in like its own class of transness.
Would you consider it to be queerness though?
I would. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay.
I think that would fit under the broader umbrella that is like, because all these people had to hide their bodies their whole lives.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Universal Friend took this a step further and disowned not just their gender, but their humanity as well.
Mm-hmm.
6 years after the possession, in 1780, the nature of the Universal Friend's teaching shifted, apparently caused by the death of a prominent follower's daughter that affected Puff deeply. The vision of an imminent end times faded into the background, and emphasis shifted to living in pure ways now. In 1785, members of the congregation were buying and developing land on the western shores of Seneca Lake. By 1790, the Friends settlement comprised 200 people in 60 families and was the largest settlement in western New York.
Hmm.
And this was very much a pioneer frontier settlement. There were local American Indians that the Society of Friends apparently had good relations with and traded with and such. But in terms of white settlement, this was way out there, away from civilization.
Mm-hmm. They were roughing it.
Yeah. They initially didn't have like sawmills and stuff. So I read stories of how they would hollow out trees to bury the initial followers who died in the first few years that moved there.
Wow.
Yeah. All of this went on while America fought a revolution, wrote a constitution, had a rebellion, and then wrote another constitution. So keeping this in mind, being in far western New York, it wasn't always clear what country they were a part of. It shifted from British to American to Indian land to American again, based on various treaties that were being signed and mm-hmm. broken and whatnot.
Did Puff have political leanings?
It seems like their focus was entirely on this Christian way of living and,
okay.
and, being the spirit, just trying to enact on earth this holy community.
Mm-hmm. A bigger time scale. Okay.
Got yeah. it. Got it. Bigger fish to fry than who we pay our taxes to. True to their Quaker roots, the Friends settlement had no strict theology beyond a strong belief in scripture as God's word. They did not practice baptism or communion, sing, dance, drink alcohol, own slaves, and apparently they dealt with their neighbors, the American Indians who lived near them, fairly.
Ugh, such a bag of things I love and hate.
I know. Although celibacy was a major focus, the Friend adored children that inevitably appeared within the community.
Every member of the community was expected to be celibate, or do you mean with outside of like the covenant of marriage?
It wasn't a strict rule, but even within marriages, the idea of any carnal lust was very much frowned upon. And the Universal Friend never had any partner or anything like that. And they preached that celibacy was the way to go.
Okay.
But children appeared in the community and they were loved and accepted and treated well, like they were an anti-children.
Maybe Puff wasn't aware of how the children came to be.
Yeah. Maybe a little hand waving.
Education
going
was
on.
Spotty back then, guys.
Unlike many of the religious leaders in the series, the Friend continued to work in the fields and didn't feel the need to intimidate or demean the followers to maintain loyalty. Hmm. Their ability as a speaker seemed to be enough. They could apparently quote the Bible at great length and had seemed to have this great inspiration. Hmm. The more eccentric tales, such as the Friend trying to raise the dead or walk on water, they seem to be slanders written by outside communities in newspapers and such.
No, I want to believe that it's true.
We were told one story. So there's a beautiful, we went to a little museum in the town of Pen Yan, which is now where these Friend settlements were.
Okay.
And we were told a story there by the guy working at the museum, which was that the Public Universal Friend, there were rumors going around that they could walk on water like Jesus. And so eventually it kind of like became a big thing in the community. So they said, okay, come out to Seneca Lake. I'll walk on the water. I'll show you all. Got all of them out there and then said, do you all believe in your hearts that I can walk on water? And everyone said, yes. And the Public Universal Friend said, then there's no need to prove it.
How convenient. So why is it always walking on water? I just feel like there are cooler mystical abilities.
Coolest thing anyone
can
do. We're
just going to skip straight past flying? To walk yeah. on water?
Well, that would be an that would be a different tenor if Jesus was just like took off into the sky in that story.
Arguably better.
Jess is rewriting the Bible for us. The Seneca Lake community fell apart in 1794 due to bad land deals and unsound contracts. So in a time when much land was bought and sold by unscrupulous speculators, there were overlapping claims to all of this land. Hmm. And then add to this, the Friend didn't exist. The Friend had no legal control over things because...
I hate when your death loophole catches up to you.
I know, right? Because Jemima Wilkinson was dead. So no court at any time ever accepted the Public Universal Friend as a person. So all of these deals had to be done through community members because Puff didn't exist. It's the downside of not of renouncing your humanity, I guess. So powerful men of the community played out petty disputes at the expense of the community's overall security.
Okay.
And the land eventually was lost. The congregation then moved to the next Finger Lake over on the banks of the Cuca. For 20 years, the community flourished until the Friend's death in 1819 at age 66. Many fully expected that a new angel would inhabit the body upon the Friend's passing, but after several weeks, the body continued to rot and was eventually interred.
Ugh. It's a pretty serious loophole.
Yeah. Without an heir, the community quickly dissipated. The trust that held the community property supported members until 1874, but spent most of that century in legal limbo because all parties contesting the ownership had died shortly after the suits began.
Wow.
So their heirs had to do this strange indirect thing through the
and
courts.
No doubt. They were like, why are we even here? Yeah. What are we doing?
Essentially. but it's interesting. The people living in Pen Yan and the surrounding towns, Dresden is one and Jerusalem is another. Mm-hmm. They're the descendants of these people and they still have Public Universal Friend artifacts in their homes and stuff.
In a positive light.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And still hold this figure as like the founder of their community.
Yeah.
Although, according to the tour guide there, they do not like the whole trans angle. The whole viewing Public Universal Friend as the first like trans American is something that they don't feel comfortable with at all.
Amazing thing about the story, though.
I know. And it's undeniable about the story as
well.
Yeah. But I think it's to do with political concerns, political values. It's kind of a rural area.
I don't want to get pro cult leader on this podcast episode, but this is the coolest.
We'll meet some good cult leaders. There are some good ones.
Because I could especially see at this time period, Jemima seeing her options as a woman and being like, you know what? Fuck this.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm going off on my own.
And even though I am pro dance and pro sexual pleasure, I could see at this time those being problematic things to even want to engage with. So, I don't know. I'm kind of
you're
Puff.
Speaking personally. You're not saying the Puff did. You're saying in this time, in although this you time, like to dance.
Although I like to dance and would have serious qualms with someone saying that sexual pleasure was the road to damnation. Mm-hmm. I could see in the context of Puff's time, understanding that that was a better option for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So I'm saying I'm pro puff in this moment.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we can be pro puff.
Okay, good, good.
In the two centuries since the friend's death, much scholarship remained rooted in transphobia and suspicion about this character. Recently, local historical societies have collected documentation and corrected many of the myths that were floating out there about the friend. A new discourse around transness has allowed scholars to see the friend more as a radical feminist,
yeah,
like a isolationist feminist,
yeah,
or a proto-trans activist.
Yeah. Now. And I think it's outrageous to me that I've never heard of this character before now.
I did a podcast exploring gender identity like this, and I didn't come across this figure.
There should be, for sure, a biography about Puff.
Yeah. By renouncing their old identity and gender, and by creating a separatist community, the public universal friend rejected the patriarchal constraints of the existing Quaker community and of American society. In the criticism of the public universal friend, we find a sadly familiar theme. Virtually all trans folks and allies have experienced or witnessed this at least once. A peevish journalist visiting the friend's community complained, quote, "It should be noted that her followers do not admit she is a woman. They, therefore, of consequence, deny her name and appear to resent it as an affront when she's called Jemima Wilkinson and declare in the most solemn manner that they know no such person." The Society of Universal Friends flatly rejected dead naming. If you're trans, I invite you to use the same response that the friend did. Quote, "There's nothing indecent or improper in my dress or appearance. I am not accountable to mortals. I am that I am."
I want to use in lots of situations, "I am not accountable to mortals."
Seems just such a great...
I won't appropriate Puff, but I want
wrong.
To.
I'm not accountable to mortals. This section is Revelation Wars, and it's about the Shakers.
Mm-hmm.
The Shakers were another Quaker offshoot during the American Revolution that had interesting ideas about gender. Their initial revelation is rooted in a woman's pain. Anne Lee, an English Quaker, labored for around 9 years with, quote, "inexpressible sufferings," while praying to be freed from sin. Not just from her sins, but from the nature of sin itself.
Mm.
Quote, "Sometimes for whole nights together, her cries, screeches, and groans were such as to fill every soul around her with fear and trembling, and could be compared to nothing but horrors and agonies of the damned in hell, whose awful states were laid upon her."
Mm.
In 1770, she received her full revelation from God. All sin was rooted in Adam and Eve's temptation of the flesh, and all lustful gratification must stop for humanity to be saved.
It must be true that basically all religion is rooted in unsatisfied sexual desires. Like, I think that's what...
This year the theory, this year theory of religion.
This is the takeaway from this podcast episode.
Yeah, I mean, I can't argue with that.
Yeah.
This was almost certainly rooted in her experience.
Yeah.
She was pregnant 8 times. Wow. 4 were stillbirths, and 4 children died in infancy.
Wow.
Now age 34, she turned against sex altogether.
I mean, fair.
I know. Through these experiences, she became a nuisance to the Manchester Quaker community. She fasted for unusually long periods of time and performed eccentric labors at their meetings, where she cried and screamed as she experienced the divine.
Wait, labors as in just general acts of divine intervention, or she was laboring?
So the Shakers always called this laboring.
Okay.
At their meetings from here on out, they would labor together. And it initially started as having a personal... So whereas Quakers, their soul was quaked by God, Shakers, she writhed and screamed as she felt God upon her.
Hence the name.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it started as an intensely personal suffering that was done in public.
Mm. How could you throw any kind of shade on a woman that has experienced that much physical pain and that much grief? Of course she's shaking. Of course. Yeah. What?
And this was later, psychoanalysts got into Ann Lee later on, and she was really pointed to as an example of like these like unconscious sufferings, like being forced to be made public, that she had to, she had experienced so much personal misery that she needed to do this in front of other people to express herself and to let the world know like what her life was.
But so interesting that we have to put these kinds of like desires and grief and just these feelings, these uncomfortable feelings in divine terms in order to make them okay.
Yeah.
To make them legitimate.
And this was the language of legitimizing personal experience was to make it divine.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
The Shakers fled England in 1774, and they settled outside of Albany, and they found themselves equally persecuted, if not more so, in New York.
Which, rude. Had the current inhabitants learned nothing?
I know. Well, 1774. Okay. We're still early.
Some time has passed.
It's unclear what made Shakers more hateful to Americans than these other eccentric religious sects, because the way that they lived was not that different from like Amish or Mennonites, who were these sort of throwback religious groups that had come over from Germany. And they weren't hated the same way that Shakers were.
I wonder if it was just the untethered emotion in their religious services.
Definitely. I think part of it. Yeah. Squeamishness, right?
Yes. How dare you show your emotions so publicly?
Yeah. But whereas Public Universal Friend was subject to a lot of slander, Ann Lee and her followers were repeatedly physically attacked in the streets and chased out of towns.
Whoa.
Shakers, like Quakers, were pacifists, and they found themselves repeatedly jailed for the crimes of being recently English and refusing to fight in the revolution.
Recently English.
We were having a revolution.
How dare they?
Men and women were dragged in the street and beaten at New Lebanon, which they were completely pushed out of, and then it later became one of their major strongholds. So initially they were completely rejected by many of these places that would eventually accept them.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when Ann Lee's body was moved to construct the Albany Airport in the mid-20th century, the airport is basically built directly on the Shaker Village. It's kind of sad. They destroyed some of the buildings for it and moved Ann Lee's body to build it.
Because they would have considered building the airport on top of her remains to be more disrespectful than moving her body? Unpack that for me. What?
I couldn't tell you. We apparently don't build municipal projects on top of graveyards if there's important people in them. We move the important person.
That being the key takeaway, probably, only if you're an important historical figure.
I think so.
Do you get exhumed?
Because surely she was buried amongst a bunch of other Shakers that are just under the airport.
And they only exhumed her.
As far as I know, yeah.
I mean, I have a lot of questions, but let's keep going.
Anyway, when it was exhumed, her bones showed repeated breaks that had healed over time. So we saw the physical evidence that she was beaten up many times.
Wow.
She would go and preach in taverns and stuff, in public houses, mm-hmm. which women weren't even allowed in to begin with. And she would often be physically attacked. And like I said, whole communities were sometimes dragged in the streets and beaten.
Wow.
By 1780, Ann Lee was preaching that celibacy ensured freedom from sin, that God was both male and female, and that the second coming was imminent. Upstate Cauldron points out that many religions have female gods or dual-gendered gods mm-hmm. or a female god surrogate.
Mm-hmm.
Catholicism elevated Jesus' mother Mary to immaculate and semi-divine status. She could be called on as an intercessor, someone who could go between the lowliness that is humanity and the greatness that is God. Reformed Protestant theology banished Mary from their discussions. Mary was no longer a part of...
I actually didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Protestants basically don't talk about Mary. It's a very minor part of the whole
story.
Listeners,
if it wasn't already clear to you, I was raised Catholic
yeah.
and am therefore floored by this revelation.
And that was one of the major criticisms of Catholicism, was that it had raised this woman basically to the level of idolatry, praising her as a god, even though she was nothing like God and merely the mother of Jesus.
Leaving this episode with a lot of issues with Protestants that I didn't realize I had before.
See, this is the thing, is we dig into these things, you're like, oh, I like that, but I don't like that. You'll feel that a lot. Protestant theology had gotten rid of Mary and had this discomforting doctrine that was predestination. Both of these things felt very aloof and, you know, disconnected from human experience.
Yeah.
So this left a gap where femininity and grace had been. Anne Lee insisted that God had equal male and female natures. Her followers soon took this idea to its obvious conclusion, and they created a dual leadership structure. So in Shaker communities, for every leadership position a man had, there was a woman with an equal amount of power.
I'm having trouble getting my arms around what the schism was. I know that newness and any kind of division would have been looked upon with skepticism, but it doesn't seem like Anne Lee was preaching all that big of a difference between Quaker and Shaker.
Yeah.
There was the, like, physical manifestation of their experience with the divine, and then masculine femininity reconfiguration. But was that it? Was that what caused them to be beaten up in the streets? Those two things?
I think so. And, like, it feels so, like, arcane to us. But I think we can relate more to what I'm going to talk about happening during the 19th century mm-hmm. as a little bit closer to us and a little bit easier to understand. I think religion... of once we start going further back, it becomes more distant to us. Like, it's really hard to understand how people got so wrapped up about some of the things they got wrapped up about.
Yeah.
And I find this really intensely when I've looked at, like, Byzantine history, like Eastern Orthodox, because that was always associated with the emperor. Mm. And so there were always political considerations. And it was things like whether you could remarry for the third time. If your first two wives died, could you marry a third time? That caused riots and, like, people murdered in the streets and, like, cities burned over this question.
Life is hard enough. Like, these are the arguments we want to have?
These are the things that we really sunk into in this time. Yeah.
Then again, in 100 years, this podcast episode will be replayed and over the soundbite of what ridiculous things we were arguing about.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we can both point to a lot of contemporary issues.
Let's not get into anti-vaxxers in this episode.
Yeah, good Lord. Then in 1784, both Anne Lee and her brother died, and they were the leadership of the Shakers.
Okay.
Leadership passed to James Whitaker, who was a weaver who had fled from England, and Joseph Meacham, who was a Connecticut ex-Baptist.
Both names sound familiar.
I mean, they're
just super American names, is maybe what it is.
They were important, and this is the era of Shakerdom that, if you know anything about Shakers, this you would know about. Okay. And I should have asked you at the beginning, I forgot, do you have any associations with Shakers?
No.
Okay.
I know Shaker-style furniture.
There we go.
And okay. That's it.
That's good. That is mostly how Shakers have lived on in our cultures.
Interesting.
Through their furniture.
Okay. And yeah. I did not know, I thought it was... I had no idea it was connected to a religious perspective at all.
So we're starting to enter that era of Shakers, which is the era of Shakers that really stuck with us.
Okay.
To be a Shaker in this new time meant to sign a covenant of Shakerdom. Mm-hmm. So the ideas had now become completely codified into an actual charter that you would need to sign.
Okay.
By signing, you swore off sin, sex, even of the procreative kind, and private property.
Interesting.
You would now live in a commune with your, they were called brethren and sisters.
Ooh. Nothing is unique and original is what I'm also learning in this journey.
It all gets regurgitated.
Please tell me there was some really weird initiation ceremony that went along with signing your covenant.
I don't think there was.
A goblet of blood that you had to drink.
I think you just put on your boringest clothes and had to go opposite ways from your husband or whatever.
Bummer. Okay, keep going.
Shaker architecture reflects this belief in men and women not cohabitating and men and women staying on opposite sides, in that the central rooms of any Shaker house have two separate entrances, and men and women needed to enter from, and they basically lived on they would live on the same floors in a building but on opposite sides of it.
Mm.
And they slept in these big communal rooms, but obviously only with people of your gender.
I think what's interesting to me here is understanding what the motivations would have been for people to join this movement. I assume that Anne Lee and her brother were super compelling figures who could preach well and were, you know, interesting and drew people to them. But as a woman myself, I totally see why that would be something you'd be interested in. You suddenly are freed from sexual violence, from pregnancy, from just the day-to-day irritations of having a dude in your space. I get it. I'm on board with that theory. But, like, the men who joined the order, what was their motivations?
Well, it's an interesting question. Yeah. And I think a lot of it comes down to practical issues. Mm. And I'll go through some of that in a second. But one thing I did notice, I went to this place, Hancock Village, which is right on the border between New York and Massachusetts, right on the Massachusetts side. And it was a active Shaker community until the 1960s. And then it was sold directly into being a museum. So it basically has this continuous lineage from its construction, which is really cool.
Yeah. And I didn't realize Shakers continued that far. Okay. Wow.
And the thing that you notice about it is that after 1900 or so, it was basically only sisters and then hired help. Virtually the only men who were on it lived in an outbuilding that was called the workhouse. So for a long time, it became very difficult to get brethren. And then because their jobs were still very segregated by gender, there were just all these jobs that needed doing.
You also have to wonder what Ann Lee and her brother were thinking, in the sense of, if you have celibacy as a big part of your covenant, your charter to join the religion, how did they think this line was going to keep going? They really didn't think this through, is what I'm trying to say.
Seems like an issue, but an important thing to keep in mind is Ann Lee preached an imminent end apocalypse.
Right. No, you said that. Okay.
So even as it got into the Meacham era, we're still everybody's talking about the imminent end of times.
Fire and brimstone is nigh.
Yeah. So it kind of didn't matter. So you kind of didn't want to have kids.
Interesting. Okay.
Because you don't really want to bring a baby into the apocalypse, per se.
Mm. Valid.
Could be. Public evangelism ceased, but permanent settlements started.
Okay.
The public was invited to watch the religious experiences of the Shakers, which became increasingly strange. The violent seizuring of Ann Lee was codified into a set of specific movements, and it looks something like Tai Chi. Shakers were accused by more conservative churches of the sin of dancing, and in time, these movements did slowly become group dances. So what was writhing slowly became a set of movements you would do that meant it, each movement meant something.
This is blowing my mind. Is the Shaker religion directly tied to ecstatic dance?
It's a very central part of Shakerdom.
What?
Yes. Okay. Of Shaker life.
What?
And in fact, their meeting houses, so Shaker furniture was this obviously a big thing. All their meeting houses, and pretty much all their houses in general, it's kind of wild, had pegs all along the outside, these peg boards everywhere. Yeah. And everything that they made, they were known for all these innovations, everything they made could be hung up on these peg boards.
Yeah.
And so at the meeting houses, all the furniture was movable, and it would all go up on the wall, and then they would have this big group labor that they would do.
I'm into it. It also feels very Danish to me. Were they of
there's definitely
British?
Dutch influence. Dutch. There's a lot of Dutch influence in this area, and they settled on old Dutch settlements in many cases.
Just that, like, practical, minimalist
aesthetic. That kind of Protestantism is definitely associated with Dutch and the sort of Puritan English aesthetic.
Oh, Instagram suddenly has so much more context for me now. This style is so popular. That idea of, like, pegs and minimalist.
Yeah.
Clean aesthetic, yeah, for sure.
Like the other eccentric Christian utopians nearby, the Mennonites and the Amish, Shakers lived in these self-sufficient communities, and they limited their interaction with the outside world as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the Mennonites and Amish, they embraced technology. Their communities became increasingly successful economic enterprises, as numerous mechanical innovations made them very productive. So Shakers invented these chairs that you could tip back. You just move a thing on the back of it, and then your chair could tip back.
Oh, like the like recline?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Not like fully recline, but and so then it wouldn't like scrape on the floor. It was like one of the Shaker innovations was no chair scrapes on the floor. They also invented the flat broom. Prior to that, brooms were basically a piece of wood, and you'd put debris. Like corn stalks were a good thing for brooms, and you just tie it around a stick. Shakers codified like a straw broom that's laid out in a flat line, and it's way more effective for sweeping than just rubbing corn stalks on your floor.
What? They invented the broom.
They invented the broom as we know it.
Love the Shakers.
Yeah. They became important community resources because they produced their own herbal medicines, and they tended to keep large surpluses of food. They had these large store rooms that mm-hmm. were built in kind of clever ways. I got to walk around a few. It was very cold on the downstairs. It was impressive.
Were they like pickling and preserving food, and that's how they were keeping it?
Yeah, they also would harvest ice. They had huge ice houses as well.
Interesting.
From okay. There were all these lakes everywhere in New York, so they would harvest ice out of the lakes in the winter. In this time, Shaker villages became accustomed to winter Shakers, who were people from nearby towns who were starving during the winter, who would come and take Shaker vows and live as Shakers through the winter, and then renounce their vows as soon as spring came.
Fair weather Shakers.
So this was one of the main ways that they got people in, was by feeding and giving jobs to people.
If that's how you want to grow your religion, it's really not a bad way to go about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Shaker communities improved as they became important industrial centers across Western New York. Shaker furniture was one of their most prized innovations. And they were said to have come directly from the archetypical world of ideas given to them by Plato himself.
Wow.
This makes Shaker furniture one of the only surviving artifacts from the burned over district that is said to have been designed by the supernatural itself. We'll talk about the only other thing I know of that's supposed to have been designed by a ghost.
Oh, I am going to collect more Shaker furniture now.
Yeah. In New Lebanon, Shaker Dumb took on the quality of a corporation. They were exporting so many things. They developed their own branding so they could sell their numerous kinds of medicines and goods. They became an important part of the booming New York economy, and the Erie Canal slowly connected up a lot of their settlements. So then they became part of this commercial network.
Were they more respected publicly now, or were people still looking down on them even though they wanted their furniture?
Yeah, once they started feeding and producing things, once their value to Americans had been proven,
yeah,
then they were liked much more.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it goes in America. In later days, Shakers became so associated with their furniture brands that a Shaker of Hancock Village declared, "I don't want to be remembered as a chair."
Oof. Yep. I'm not sure you're going to get that wish.
I know. After Ann Lee's death, she no longer had a monopoly on the divine revelation. Unlike her more egotistical peers, Ann Lee was more exalted after her death than she was during her life.
Interesting.
In 1808, the Shakers learned that Ann Lee had been the female manifestation of Jesus, and that her life had been the second coming of Jesus. In 1837, Anne Mariah Goff learned from Lee directly that the Day of Judgment was in fact close at hand, along with specific personal criticisms for the other Shaker leaders.
Ooh.
Later that year, girls in the original Shaker community
of Water Valete
received many supernatural accusations from individuals that led to expulsions and investigations. Shakers spoke to Lafayette, to Washington, Napoleon, and to Indian chiefs. Some would speak in tongues and act in a savage and boisterous way when they channeled their Indian guides. This laid the groundwork for spiritualists to speak to the dead, often channeling the voices and physicality of so-called savage or primitive peoples.
Wait, the Shakers were speaking to the dead by pantomiming.
So a Shaker would be inhabited or whatever by a primitive person and would grunt and, you know, do
dance
these primitive movements.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
This period is called the Era of Manifestations, and it destabilized Shaker communities but also led to a huge swelling of membership. And at its height in 1840, over 5,000 Americans were parts of Shaker covenants.
Wow.
Yeah. There
Again,
were like
20
major villages.
How is this not a bigger deal?
I know. Yeah, they were a huge movement. Shakers produced songs and art that was supposedly divinely inspired, and they're woven into America's folk traditions.
Mm-hmm.
One song in particular, Simple Gifts, shows up again and again when we talk about American folk music. So here is a version that is pretty similar to what you would have heard from the Shakers.
Thank goodness I am very unaccustomed to a podcast episode here without audio clips. Mm. I feel a lot better now.
Yeah, finally you got some audio clips. I was thinking about that.
'Tis the gift to be simple, 'tis the gift to be free, 'tis the gift to come down where you want to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight.
So that's the basic melody of Simple Gifts.
Very familiar.
Yeah. So here's a few more versions through time. This is when Copeland added it into his ballet for Appalachian Spring.
Mm.
So that piece, Copeland essentially labeled this as an essential piece of American history.
I prefer option number one pretty strongly.
A little startling. As of 2008, Simple Gifts made two notable appearances on the world stage. One, John Williams incorporated it into the music that was played at Obama's inauguration. So this was a theme that was played for Obama. And also in 2008, we got this song. That's the Weezer song, Greatest Man Who Ever Lived, Variations on a Shaker Hymn.
Punk Shaker.
You're going to get beat up for calling Weezer punk.
It's true.
Shakers would go on vacations, but only to other Shaker villages, and they customarily would compose a song to thank their hosts when they left.
Mm.
So many new songs were composed that a general moratorium was called on songwriting at various times.
Why would you ever do that?
They needed to learn some of the songs that had been written. In this time, Shaker dances became codified group rituals, and the outsiders, the world, as they were called, were no longer invited to watch.
Ooh.
You may have seen depictions of some of these Shaker dances online, because they do look like the Thriller dance.
Listeners, I can verify that looks like old school Thriller for sure.
Songs such as Come Life, Shaker Life show the tension between Shaker views and of their laboring and the disapproval from the outside world. Because dancing still in many quarters was considered not a proper religious thing to be doing.
I really want to pinpoint one neat thing to motivate all of these early religions. It seems like sexual deviance, any kind of otherness that you wanted to inhabit, but maybe it was just as simple as some people wanted to dance.
Some people did really want to dance. And it seems like being a Shaker was like kind of a nice life. You lived this communal life, and then when you wanted to sing, you sang, and when you wanted to dance, you danced, and it was just considered part of like life.
I've never had a house guest write a departure song for me, and I really want it now.
Right. So when the Shakers sing, I'll take nimble steps, I'll be a David, I'll show Michael how he behaved, they're arguing that the wild dancing they're doing has a strong biblical precedent. It's not an unholy carnal act that the Puritans say it is.
And who gets to decide that one person's form of grace is better than another's? You may want to sit quietly in your friendship group. Other people want to get down.
And dance it out, yeah. And it became things that would go on for hours and hours. And so I think you can kind of compare it to some of the like more, I don't know, like animist, like pagan type rituals type stuff where Shakers would dance for 20 hours on end until people were literally dropping you know, in the meeting house. And this is an old form of religious worship that people have done, you know, from the beginning of time.
Yeah.
Dance until you literally can't anymore.
Yeah, no, I feel like it's written into our DNA as humans to do that. Yeah. Although I will say, if you ever go to an ecstatic dance, like, ceremony at all, report back. Because I think if you're raised Catholic, they strip that from you. I felt very uncomfortable. Wow. I was like, I want to get into it, but where's the incense?
Well, I will say that when I went to Hancock Village, I did dance this Come Life, Shake Your Life dance.
How was it?
It was great. It was me and like five kids and like two old people and the guide. And we did Come Life, Shake Your Life.
I can so easily picture that.
I almost got the video, but then I was like, I don't know if I can share on my blog a video of that a random parent took of their children doing a shaker dance.
Yeah, that's on the edge.
Might
for sure.
be a little gray legality there.
Listeners, let's all just close our eyes and picture it. Yeah.
Gangle Man. And the toddlers. Although strict abolitionists, Shakers did not participate in the Civil War and became America's first recognized conscientious objectors.
Wow.
They lost much of their clout as industrial factories eclipsed their craftsman-oriented workshop style.
And suddenly we were on the dark road to IKEA.
Exactly. As conversion slowed, Shaker numbers rapidly dwindled. Because they did not have children, and they exiled people who did have children because they broke the covenant.
Oh, see,
From the public universal friend,
yeah,
you signed a covenant saying you wouldn't have sex. So if you had children, you were out.
Ooh, they could have really taken something from the Puff playbook there.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
Seriously. As a result, the major source of Shaker recruitment was adopting illegitimate and orphaned children. That was mostly how they got kids.
Mm.
And if you were taken into a Shaker community this way, you were indentured until you were 18 or so.
What?
And apparently, so yeah, you were forced to stay there until you were an adult. And apparently only about 10% of kids raised in this way stayed Shakers. The other 90% left.
Wow.
So that goes to show how much people liked being raised as Shakers. Yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, just a few years ago, the last person raised as a Shaker died. So there are a few remaining Shakers, but they were not raised in the tradition.
I do think even though they had reincorporated the dancing, which props to them, being raised to fundamentally disagree with a basic need is really hard.
Yeah, that does seem hard, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Over the 20th century, government agencies pushed religious organizations out of fostering and adopting children.
Okay.
And so this route of becoming a Shaker disappeared. In 1992, only one Shaker covenant remained open. And as of its 2019 newsletter, there are three Shakers remaining, all of whom are over 60 years old.
Important question. Do you subscribe to this newsletter?
I may have gotten a few... of the newsletter. in terms of staying power, we can place Shakers somewhere on the middle of the scale between Universal Friend and like Mormons. If anything, it's amazing they lasted as long as they did, given no reproduction.
Do they have special underwear?
No special underwear that I know of.
Wow.
But they did do kind of the plain dress thing of the Amish people.
Okay. But they still hold on to the no sex rule.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. The organization of the community into a closed commune provided economic and doctrinal support for the movement to flourish after the death of the leader. So they were able to keep together because they did kind of turn insular when Ann Lee died.
Okay.
And made this eccentric thing that could live on beyond her.
Yeah.
Shaker ideas and settlements form the background of many of the stories that are going to follow. This game of one-upsmanship that comes from delivering personal messages from the divine would soon happen all across New York State.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So that's
the Shakers. You got any other Shaker questions?
I was really anticipating that I was going to be, I am pro Shaker, but the fact that they didn't update and rebrand and get rid of the no sex thing, it's a bummer.
But I did see they built garages and they had cars. They had cool cars in the turn of the century.
Yeah, cars are not going to make up for that, though. You got to get with the times.
Cruising in a cool car with your other Shaker buds?
Sounds like with three of them, there's not much cruising that can happen.
That's fair.
I'm glad I am a Shaker, I'm glad I am a Shaker, I'm glad I am a Shaker, followers of the Lamb. I'm glad I am a Shaker, I'm glad I am a Shaker, I'm glad I am a Shaker, you followers of the Lamb. Sing on, dance on, followers of Emmanuel. Sing on, dance on, you followers of the Lamb. Sing on, dance on, you followers of Emmanuel. Sing on, dance on, you followers of the Lamb.
Okay, this section is called close reading.
Okay.
The other Protestant method.
I'm already ready to be pissed.
The other Protestant method for knowing the divine focused on closely reading scripture and interpreting its meaning for yourself, as guided by the Holy Spirit, of course. William Miller took this idea further than most and calculated an exact date for the second coming, using a much simpler system than existing occult and Kabbalistic approaches to this problem.
William Miller?
New guy.
Okay.
New guy. In fact, Miller was notably less mystical than his surroundings. He had no interest in mystical get-rich-quick schemes like his contemporary Joseph Smith. Miller was a deist in his younger days and would poke fun at his uncles and grandfather's preaching as Baptist ministers. He dreamed of glory in war, and he was more than happy to enlist in the War of 1812. Losing close friends and coming so close to death himself changed Miller, and at age 33, he began a new search for meaning. Inspired by the various strains of Protestantism around him, Miller set out to understand the Bible as a single coherent piece of divine work. He pored through the King James Bible with Cruden's Concordance, which is a text that attempts to link all the prophecies of the Old Testament to events in the New Testament, a way of proving that Jesus was the prophesied Messiah.
Oh.
Yeah. Miller told his friends, "Give me time and I will harmonize all those apparent contradictions to my own satisfaction, or I will be a deist still." What followed closely resembles the research process we see with modern conspiracy theorists.
Yes.
Miller ignored all historical context and virtually all biblical scholarship,
yep,
and used only as his source the 1611 English translation of the Bible, which wasn't even drawn from the early Greek, Latin, and Aramaic sources. It was drawn from a wide range of Bibles that had been published all throughout the Middle Ages.
Good,
more focused on telling the story poetically than being true to the initial sources of the Bible.
First of all, I need a copy of that Bible.
This is the King James. This is where so many English phrases come from. Insert list here that I don't have right now. But here is the list. And to clarify, most of these were not coined by the King James Bible, but it did expose many English speakers to these idioms for the first time, and it's considered a highly influential work for enriching and developing the English language. So these phrases include, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, a cross to bear, a drop in the bucket, a fly in the ointment, a labor of love, a man after his own heart, at wit's end, to bite the dust, by the skin of your teeth, seeing eye to eye, the fat of the land, in the twinkling of an eye, manna from heaven, to cast pearls before swine, to set your teeth on edge, the straight and narrow, the apple of his eye, and wheels within wheels. So many, like, if there's like a turn of phrase that you know is old in English, it's either Shakespeare or it's King James. It's invented a lot of our language.
That checks out.
Okay. Okay. I thought you had another thing.
I was going to mock you for not having the phrases ready, but I decided to burn my tongue.
God!
I'm trying to change my ways, guys.
The King James translation is noted for its ingenuity of language and poetic phrases, but not for its accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
Miller used only this translation and a handful of English language concordance guides to reconstruct the mind of God from this coherent divine work.
I'm imagining an actual pegboard with sticky notes on it, even though obviously those did not exist, and red twine connecting all of them.
Feels very much like that moment is going on. From this unlikely beginning, he achieved something that theologians had been failing to do for over a millennium. He calculated the timing of the second coming and the last judgment. Miller was a literalist in the sense that he thought that the Bible was directly written by God through man, but not in the sense that everything should be taken literally. So he came to the conclusion that Daniel 8:14, which reads, "Unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed." meant that the second coming and final judgment would happen 2,300 years later after the time of Daniel, rather than weeks. So he said God wrote it right, literally, just swapped out weeks for years.
Common mistake, really.
Common mistake when you're God. he took the prophecy of Daniel as occurring in 457 BC, so therefore the world would end in 1844 AD. This was about 25 years in the future from when Miller said it.
How convenient.
Christians, especially Baptists, flocked to this idea.
Yeah, why are we as a people, maybe specifically as Americans, so into end times? We love
really
it.
Want it to end.
Oh, we are so happy for this thing to burn.
Yeah.
Why?
I think it is related to like religious perfectionism and American perfectionism, where you're like, we're going to make a perfect country and it's going to be so perfect that God's going to look at it and be like, that's perfect.
And then burn it to the ground?
Well, and then the whole, well, okay, there's kind of two ways of looking at it. Everybody dies and gets saved, or the world itself becomes holy, Christian, perfect from pole to pole.
Ooh, I just feel like you're really skimming over the pain and misery that comes hand in hand with that.
Ooh. Yeah, you think there might be a little. It's going to be a tough transition.
Yeah, it's going to be a little bit. It's going to be discomfortable.
Yeah,
as doctors would say.
Yeah, this is a huge part of American religion.
Yeah.
Miller began a new life as an itinerant preacher, warning that all sin would need to be expunged by 1844. If parishioners wanted to avoid damnation. The simplicity of Miller's logic attracted widespread support that some more so than some of the more eccentric ideas that were floating could. This was something that appealed to all Christians.
Okay.
Except Catholics. But there weren't a lot of them. In 1833, nature seemed to confirm his insight. The Leonid meteor shower lit up the night sky and convinced both William Miller and Joseph Smith that they had been correct in believing that the second coming was close at hand. It remains a key event in the historiography of both Seventh-day Adventists and Mormons. This is something they look back on as
interesting
holy confirmation.
You can't just enjoy the natural wonders. You've got to turn
just
it
see
into
a meteor
a sign.
Shower. It has to be God spitting be on the earth.
It's the sign of end times, of course.
Miller stands out as being much less egotistical than other religious leaders. Between 1834 and 1839, he gave 800 lectures, unpaid, only upon invitation, and paid for his own expenses and as he traveled relentlessly around New England.
That makes him less egotistical?
He didn't live off of his followers the way that a lot of these people did.
Okay, but, you know.
Okay,
still
that's
love
fair.
The sound
that's
of
fair
his own
criticism. He didn't really like to talk.
Yeah.
But I guess what I mean is that he strikes me as more of a true believer than most people. Over this time, Miller gained rich and powerful supporters who broadcast his message to a much wider audience. By 1840, he was lecturing across the Midwest to multi-thousand seat city halls.
Wow.
With this growing popularity came backlash. Newspapers printed satirical articles, creating the myth that believers wore special ascension robes and that they had sold all their property in anticipation for the physical rapture. These are things that often get mentioned around this event that there's no real historical proof of. Millerite assemblies faced mob hostility, from egg throwing to actual violent assault.
Okay.
Biblical scholars and preachers largely mocked Miller's interpretations of the Bible, but when preaching, often left open the possibility that he could be right.
It's important to hedge your end times bets. Yeah.
Well, a lot of them did preach an imminent end times.
Yeah.
It's just the question of 1844 that some of them were like,
guys,
could
listen,
be 1844.
We're going to all die soon, just not that soon. Yeah.
Could be 1844.
Maybe.
Maybe. Finally, it was 1843.
Okay.
The Jewish calendar begins on the spring equinox, which left a year from March 21st of 1843 to 44 for the end times to occur.
Okay.
Beginning in February of that year and peaking in March, a bright comet with one of the longest tails in recorded history was seen in the sky. Cultures around the world wondered about its meaning, but Millerites knew for certain. Astronomers estimate that the Earth will see this comet again in 500 to 700 years. Fun fact. Had to look it up. When are we going to see it? A newspaper article in 1843 suggested that Miller's Second Coming was being preached by a wide range of mainstream churches, including Episcopal, Methodist, Baptist, Calvinist, and Lutheran.
After this particular comet, or just because he'd become so popular?
Just in the year that this is all
culminating. Okay, I just didn't know if the comet, like, really...
I think the comet, you know, just cranked that... that meter up one more level.
I get it.
And yet, astute students of history will know that the world did not end on March 21st, 1844.
Excuse me?
When this date came and went without fanfare, Miller admitted that he may have had an error in his calculations and convinced himself and his followers that the true date would be October 22nd.
He should have... Listen, math is hard, but you really have to think long-term.
Seems kind of important. Yeah. And he was working on it for like 25 years.
I think that, you know, when you realize that you're wrong and that you need to make up a new date, maybe you should pick something a little bit further out.
He wrote to his closest friend and supporter, "I cannot refrain from congratulating you daily on the glorious prospect we have of soon entering the gates of our beloved city and soon harping on the golden harps, the everlasting song of Alleluia to the Lamb."
Again, the hunger and thirst for the end times really confuses me.
It's wild. Unfortunately for Miller, October 22nd proved as uneventful as March 21st.
As proven by the fact that we are, in fact, two humans recording this podcast in the year 2021.
Adventists would have something to say about
that. Oh, okay.
We'll get to that later. believers had a wide range of responses to this event, and it's become known as the Great Disappointment.
This is the Great Disappointment. Good to know. Okay, good.
The overwhelming majority became disillusioned with their churches and became recruits for other eccentric movements that we'll talk about.
This is what I have to say, though, Miller. You really needed to kick this a couple years down the road for your own sake.
Not just a few months.
This is just a planning error.
Some believe that Miller had simply miscalculated and was correct about everything else.
Yeah.
And that we just didn't know when the end time was, but everything else he was talking about was true. Some believe that God had shut the door on that date, and so any sinners at that point and anyone who had sinned after that point wouldn't get into heaven. This is the final judgment happened then, we just didn't notice.
And that due to their own sin, they hadn't been worthy enough to make
it was like, we thought we were going to get raptured or whatever.
Yeah.
But since we didn't, we just got judged. So now we're either saved or not saved as we walk around this earth.
Oh, that because is an interesting way to get
judgment,
around that.
The judgment happened, we just didn't notice.
Right. It was a low-key judgment.
It was a low-key judgment.
Okay. Yeah,
exactly.
Got it.
This was comforting to some of them, but less so for many of their descendants who were born after this date.
Yeah.
And finally, a group believed in a vision that a follower had on the same day as the Great Disappointment. He looked up at the clouds and saw, quote, "The high priest entered the second apartment of that sanctuary, and he had a work to perform in the most holy place before coming to earth." And this is the belief that most Adventists took on, was that on that date, Jesus entered the second apartment.
His lease was up.
But here's the thing. You can't just go straight to earth. There's a series of waiting rooms and antechambers.
The property ladder to earth is complicated.
And Jesus, I mean, one time he got born to a human woman. Cool, great.
Yeah.
But you can't use that method every time.
Yeah. He got dead that time. So he had to restart.
So now he's going to the second apartment.
I totally get it. Hopefully it had better lighting. Yeah, hardwood floors. Wait, what?
I don't know. Apartment? I literally don't know. I cannot tell you. This is a new revelation thing. As far as I know, I don't know any precedent for the idea that heaven has multiple apartments before you get to earth.
I thought purgatory was complicated.
I know, right?
Now there's a series of apartments?
Interesting you should mention that. Purgatory does play into this in a little bit.
Of course it does. Please go on.
Yeah. After some soul searching, Millerites held a conference in Albany the following year. Since Millerites came from a wide variety of Protestant churches, they could agree on very little shared theology.
Mm.
The only broad agreement was that they were now living in the end times, and the world would continue to be perfected until such a point when Jesus would return. So there were kind of two ways of looking at this, and Miller took the opposite view. The Adventist said, the world slowly becomes more perfect as we fix parts of it, and then once the world is perfect, then that's when the judgment is like done happening, and then we're living in truly, truly end times. Miller took the opposite view. Yeah, we're only in like a little bit of times. But Miller took the opposite view, which was that the world would continue to get worse and worse and be ruled by worse and worse people, and then a cataclysmic event would happen, and then that would be the actual final judgment.
The tagline for American religion is, we are probably in end times, we think.
Yeah. Might be. Yeah. This became a huge, huge part of American religion.
Yeah.
So this group who ignored Miller called themselves the Adventists because they believed that the Second Advent had happened on 1844.
And draw a line for me between Adventists and Seventh-day Adventists of today.
So just over time, a certain group of them came to believe that the actual Sabbath is not Sunday, it's Saturday. We'd just gotten it wrong.
It's important to split hairs on this.
Yeah. And so... there were the Adventists, and then that group were the Seventh-day Adventists because they celebrated the Sabbath on the seventh day instead of the sixth.
I'll be honest. I'm really disappointed by how literal that is. Yeah. I thought it was going to be cooler than that.
It's not great. I'm sorry. This loose collection of Christians split over and over again about different questions of doctrine, of course. And there were more revelations that continued to happen that mm-hmm. not everybody got on board with.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike Miller, Adventists reported direct revelations from God to guide them. Miller only read the Bible. These people started talking to God.
Yeah.
The most lasting denomination came to believe from Bible study that the Sabbath was Saturday, not Sunday. Those are the Seventh-day Adventists. As of 2016, around 20 million Americans are baptized Seventh-day Adventists.
Wow, and they that's still preach staggering.
I know, it's tons. And they still preach that Judgment Day is right around the corner, or that we are currently living in end times.
Don't you get bored with that?
Just year after year.
Wow, mm-hmm. Okay.
Perhaps the most famous Adventists were a group led by Victor Hautef, who had been disfellowshipped by his congregation
in 1929.
Disfellowshipped? It's a formal process where the Adventist community shuns a member who's considered too far outside the orthodoxy.
Ooh.
So he got his Adventist card removed, essentially.
Ouch.
But he still considered himself an Adventist.
Okay.
Hautef's response was a 172-page manuscript criticizing Adventist faith. His ideas proved so popular that in 1934, he bought land near Waco, Texas, and built a small community called the Mount Carmel Center.
I was wondering when this was going to come into play.
In 1942, they named themselves the Davidian Seventh-day Adventists.
Yeah.
After Hautef's death in 1955, the community dissipated and fractured. The Mount Carmel Center lay vacant for decades until a descendant of the Davidian Church, calling themselves Branch Davidians, mm-hmm. moved back in the 1990s. This group abandoned the beliefs of Hautef in favor of a new prophet, a charismatic and egotistical Vernon Howell, who legally changed his name to David Koresh in 1990.
Mm.
The name references the Persian ruler, Cyrus the Great.
I didn't know that. Koresh
in Hebrew.
Okay.
And he is credited with returning the Jews from exile to Babylon. So in the same way, he was going to return the lost souls of Christianity.
Of course.
To Waco, Texas.
Right. Listeners, please go watch the Netflix miniseries about this. It is excellent.
Yes. In 1993, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives attempted to search the compound for illegal weapons, and it quickly escalated into a siege. After a 51-day standoff, the Mount Carmel Center caught fire and killed 76 Branch Davidians, including two children, two pregnant women, and David Koresh. Adventist preachers also inspired Jehovah's Witnesses. Adventist pastor George Stetson influenced Charles Days Russell to begin his own close readings of the Bible. The resulting Bible study movement predicted the end of the world in 1914. Unlike Adventists, Russell believed that a small number of the elect would become sleeping saints when they appear to die. He laid out a fairly specific chronology over the following years, which Jehovah's Witnesses believed to a greater or lesser extent. Russell lived to see many of his predictions fail. No living saints were raptured in 1878. He also lived past 1914, which believers still claim was the year in which Satan came to rule over Earth.
Wow.
We are currently living in end times under Satan's yoke.
Okay. I mean, I feel that that is true for sure. But sleeping saints?
Sleeping saints. People who die. It's similar to the preserved bodies of Catholicism.
Yeah.
You'll appear to die, but actually you continue to live on. And you're going to be raptured. And
how did
so
that work
on,
out
be
for
an
them?
Important person. A lot of them tended to rot, I think. Russell died in 1916, leading to various more schisms and scandals. The Watchtower Society, as they called themselves, stopped being quite so specific with their end time predictions. Their most recent great disappointment happened in 1975, when the end of the world yet again failed to happen.
Oof, it's a blow.
I know. Right now, there's around 9 million Jehovah's Witnesses.
Although I have never experienced any in my adult life. Have you?
I lived in a neighborhood where I had some come to the door. And they were like, you ever read the Bible? And I was like, yeah. But I know a little bit about what you believe.
It was an ongoing neighborhood warfare when I was a kid. My mother putting out more Catholic paraphernalia to hopefully deter the awkward
to
ward
them off. Yes. Enough Marys to
so many
away.
Marys, you have no idea.
Aggressively virgin marrying them. Yes. All right, that's the end of section two.
Woo!
Woo! Section three, we talk about Mormons.
Okay. All I'm right. excited. On sexual relations in that community.
Oh, you'll learn. You'll hear all about how they had sex. I know, that's a fuck, man.
I'm ready to hate it.
But yeah, went with no books, came back with old-fashioned soups and Humphrey noise on the sexual relations of the Oneida community.
Again, in the Venn diagram of my interests, this is a circle. Good chowder and weird sexual effects.
That's the quote on the box. All right. Okay.